So I'd like to discuss very briefly the efforts that I've been doing the past 2 years with my group in Lisbon, trying to understand how fundamental fields, mostly scalars, behave in strong field gravity or weak field gravity but self-gravitating solutions. So of course, the first question you might ask is, why am I interested in understanding scalars in gravitational fields? There's a lot of reasons for that. The first is that many attempts at modifying GR introduced scalar fields. For example, the first attempts by Jordan, Brands, and Dicke use a scalar field non-minimally coupled to the curvature. A scalar field is nice because, you know, it avoids introducing Lorentz violating terms. It has all the symmetries you want. If you want it not to break the equivalence principle, you can couple it minimally in the equations. If you want to break the equivalence principle, you just add it non-minimally to field equations. We know they exist. We have at least one example, which is the Higgs field. Some of them are thought to exist. For example, in the strong CP problem, you introduce a scalar field to basically lower the electric dipole moment of neutrons. This is the Pecci-Quinn mechanism. And I think they're still taken seriously as a component of dark matter, for example, axions. Actually, this was one of the first motivations for us to start looking to this, because one of the statements that you can find, out there very frequently, is that as dark matter piles in the core of compact stars, eventually it leads to a gravitational collapse. But, you know, these statements are always done kind of hand-waving with no, within no rigorous framework. So I'd like to understand that a bit in more detail. And I'll show you what we find when we model dark matter as a fundamental scalar field. So my talk is going to be, well, heavily based in a number of works, but the most important ones are this, done in collaboration with Hirotada Okawa, now in Tokyo, Paolo Pani, now in Rome, Vitek in Cambridge, moving to Nottingham, and Richard Brito in Lisbon, I think he's visiting today or so. Well, he's coming today. So I'm going to consider a very, very simple theory, basically just a minimally coupled scalar, which can be complex. The scalar field has a mass parameter mu s. Well, I'm trying to make the point that this is just a model for very, so I'm trying to make a point that all the qualitative features I'm going to discuss are common to other theories. And sometimes I will also show you results for a Proca theory, okay? A massive vector field with mass parameter mu. Sometimes it's hard to keep a track on what exactly the parameter mu means. And I'm always going to be discussing a dimensionless parameter, mu times a mass. For example, if this scalar forms a self-gravitating star with mass capital N, then the dimensionless coupling parameter M mu is like the, goes like this, 10 to the 4 for a solar mass star and a boson mass of 10 to the minus 5 electron volt. Okay? So the first thing you can ask is, well, this theory is so simple. Can it form self-gravitating solutions? Self-gravitating static solutions. And in general, well, this particular theory cannot. Actually, there is a very general result by Derek in the 60s that says that if you consider this action in Minkowski, in a Minkowski spacetime, actually with a very generic self-interaction potential, there are no static solutions, okay? The argument is a two-line calculation, a scaling argument, and the result is there are none. You can go to the other extreme and look at strongly self-gravitating solutions and, you know, ask if there are Wackel solutions which have a scalar hair outside. And the answer is, if the hair is time independent, there are no solutions, well, other than the trivial one, the Schwarzschild solution. Okay? So no non-trivial time-independent spherically symmetric solutions. So you need to add a bit more complications. So I'm going to consider the next possible simple thing, which is an harmonic time dependence. Okay? So my field, which at this stage is still either real or complex, is going to have this form. This is spherical symmetry. An important point here, and that's an important difference between complex and real fields, is that if this guy, phi r, this phi is real, then for complex fields of this form, the stress tensor is time independent, okay? So you could think, at least in principle, that there might exist solutions to the coupled Einstein-Klein-Gordon system, which have a time independent metric while the field has this time dependence. If the field is real, for example, if you try to solve the field equations with a sine of omega t here and the real phi, you will have a hard time finding, of course, static solutions to the metric, because this guy, the right-hand side of the field equations, is no longer time-independent, okay? Now, if you plug these ansatz in the field equations and you take a metric of this form, this is the most general spherically symmetric ansatz, you will find the following three equations for the three unknowns, nu, lambda, and the field phi, okay? And you can solve them by imposing regularity at, well, you can try to find a solution, imposing regularity at the origin, and of course, a syntactically flat spacetime at spatial infinity. This is basically an eigenvalue problem for the frequency omega. The quantity nu at the origin is left undetermined. You can just rescale, you know, you can just rescale omega or nu. So it's the same thing. Nu and omega are related, basically. If you rescale time, you will find a different nu at the origin, okay? So let me now go on for the complex case where phi, this phi is a real quantity. Oh, sorry, yes. If phi is real, so if phi is not a complex constant but is real, of course, this is no longer time independent, so the metric will depend on time, but you can find still a superposition of Fourier components. So you basically decompose both the field and the metric in Fourier modes. And you solve the equations instead of solving just for these three functions, you solve them Fourier mode by Fourier mode, okay? And hopefully, and that's the case almost always, you get a series that converges quite fast. So typically you need 3-4 mode components if you're not at very compact star situation. Just another thing, the reason why these solutions exist is that for a Klein-Gordon field in Minkowski, you'll find that the solutions at large distance behave like this. So omega was the Fourier parameter, and mu s is the mass parameter. So if the frequency parameter omega is smaller than the mass parameter, you basically get one solution which is exponentially suppressed. So the regular solution is exponentially suppressed, okay? Now, this is a problem for real fields because, you know, because the metric is time dependent, you are forced to add a ladder of frequency components. And that means that at some point, one of the jth mode will not satisfy this condition. So one of the jth mode will have a frequency that is larger than the mass parameter. What this means in practice is that the solutions, there are, you can build them, you can build the solutions, but in practice, they are not truly stationary solutions of the field equations. small amount of mass is being radiated away as time goes by. Okay? You can estimate the amount of radiation or the lifetime of these solutions. And well, the lifetime is huge. For all realistic mass parameters, you get the time of decay of these solutions, which is 10 to 300 for a 10 to the minus 3 electron volt boson. Okay? So huge lifetime. Okay, so the solutions look like this. I'm going to fix the scalar at the origin, at the center. I'm going to shoot for a frequency, and then I compute the mass and radius of the solution. By radius, I mean the point at which 99% of the mass is located. Okay? And then I vary the central value of the field, and I do an MR diagram. So this is the mass of my star. This is a self-gravitating scalar star. Okay? As a function of the radius of the star. And I'm going to do this both for the complex case and the real case. By the way, let me do some terminology here. I'm going to call the complex scalar case a boson star, and the real scalar case an oscillotron. There's a bunch of names out there. I'm going to use these two. Oscillotrons for real and bosons for complex. The zeroth order mode of a oscillotron is a boson star, basically. Okay, so the mass diagram of these objects look very similar. This is for the scalar case. Blue line is the boson star, complex field. Red line, oscillotron. The line actually continues a bit more and it bends down here. But I'm using a shooting method, and you know it takes a lot of time to look at this bending here. You can also do this for the massive vector. You find a very similar diagram. I don't know why people didn't look into this before, but it's here. Well, it bends down at some point here as well, and the oscillotron and boson star look very much the same as well. This field theory. Yeah, with A in general complex quantity.
So are you modeling a star as a scalar field? Is that what you're doing? Or are you taking the scalar field and adding a bunch of them together to make a star?
No, I'm forming a single coherent star out of one scalar.
So for the mass is mu, the mass of the scalar is mu.
The mass of the scalar, well, the mass parameter. Yeah.
So the maximum mass is 10 to the minus 3 electron volts?
Right. So I don't know if this answered your question.
I was just, so you said it's just a sum of fields that all pile up together, right? Is that what's happening?
No, this is one field.
Just the, okay. So I imagine it's not like you're quantizing it.
No.
Or you don't have some keg with a bunch.
No.
Okay, so it's just one.
Just one field. The scalar is neutral, yeah. You can build these solutions for scalar. Ruffini did that some years ago. You can add charge to this guy, you'll still find solutions.
But just to get back to the phenomenology, you have these really long-lived, stable oscillotrons and boson stars, but they can't be heavier than the mass of the scalar, the fundamental mass of the scalar. So then, does that mean that these...
Why? So wait, let me go there.
Because you had a maximum.
Yeah, so the maximum mass, actually, going to your question, this is an important, actually, point in the diagram, okay? It is, well, there's very general arguments that you can make, and I'm going to show you they're correct, that beyond this point, to the left of this point, these configurations are dynamically unstable, okay? I'm going to show this is true. I'm also going to call this part of the diagram the S branch, the stable branch, and this part of the diagram, which I anyway cut, the U branch, the unstable branch. Now, this point here, actually this one, corresponds to the maximum mass that these self-gravitating solutions can have, and it goes like 10 to the minus 11 solar masses for a 1 electron volt field, okay?
Then what is this mu in your plot?
So this mu, so mu m is a dimensionless quantity. Mu was the mass parameter of the boson. M is the total mass of the star. I'm just, you know. You go here. The only thing I did was this. M times mu is the dimensionless quantity I'm plotting. Maybe it's not helpful.
No, that's fine. I'm just trying to see how you get such a big number when it seems like mu is the mass of your boson.
Right.
Which is extremely tiny.
Right.
And then your plot seems to plateau at
m more and more.
This is fine. Actually, you can use the same arguments as you can use a Landau type argument to actually predict this point. Yeah, for the maximum, you know, Chandrasekhar mass. That's fine.
I thought you said that the oscillate quantums were always unstable.
That's correct.
Okay, so not just to the left of that.
They're always, but yeah, the time scale is huge.
Okay, so the entire curve is unstable. But
that's true. Yes. So my statement only referred to the boson stars.
Oh.
And actually, oscillatons develop a much stronger instability to the left of this point. So it's a dynamical time. On dynamical timescales, it becomes unstable. Not like 10 to 30 years, 300. Okay? Okay. So by the way, these are nodeless solutions. So if you plot the scalar field, it's never zero except at very, very large distances. And it's very important, I think, that there are solutions with nodes. There are n solutions where the scalar field crosses the axis. Okay? So there's many other nodes. Actually, this means that in principle there are solutions where the star can go to when you perturb it, and I think this will be an important point.
So the energy is very
yeah. Well, because you can't, so you, for a fixed mass, you can have a star with a one node, two nodes, three nodes. You see that, yeah. Well, but it means that if you disturb the star, it has a place to go to. Yeah. And, well, I'll come back to this point. So you could think about trying to build solutions like this in other theories. Usually, they exist. Always you can have very non-trivial self-interaction terms. You can look at, for instance, theories without an explicit mass term. For example, you couple non-minimally the scalar to matter, and what you will find, of course, is that then there is a term that couples the scalar to the trace of the stress tensor. That gives us an effective mass, and it also means you can build solutions that look like this. Okay? The solutions are very general, but you always look something, you always need something like a mass term in the equations of motion for some reason.
Sorry, when you say in our theories, of what, gravity?
Of gravity, yeah. I'm not going to be discussing rotation a lot, but of course these solutions also exist when you have rotation. In fact, I will be discussing at the very end that a complex scalar field can actually give rise to a new hairy black hole solution. Okay? So just a rotating black hole surrounded by a cloud of scalar field. And it turns out that rotating boson stars are continuously connected to these hairy solutions. This means that you can take a spinning boson star and add a small black hole at the center if the black hole is spinning at just the right rate. So they exist spherically symmetric or with rotation. Question, are they stable? To analyze stability, you just have to kick the scalar field and all the metric components and look at what comes out. So I'm going to kick the scalar with a function that goes like e to the capital omega t. If I, well, you turn, you get a set of four equations for four variables because now the field is in general complex as well. You turn the problem, it's an eigenvalue problem, you get four coupled ODEs, you solve for this omega. If omega is complex, it means that the field just oscillates. If omega is real, you get an instability. Okay? And I'm zooming in. So I'm, for each mass in the mass radius diagram, I'm showing you the most, well, the fundamental frequency, capital omega. Okay? So below this line here, omega squared is negative, so this is stable. Above this line, it's unstable. Okay? The turning point here, this is for a vector, it's roughly 1.06, and it's exactly this point here. Okay? So these stars, and you can show the same holds true for the scalar case. These stars turn dynamically unstable at precisely, at least up to numerical precision, at precisely the peak in the mass radius diagram. Okay? So what I call the S branch, the stable branch, well, it's stable to the right of the peak. So we know they exist. We know they are stable, at least in the vast part of the parameter space. I would like now to know if they are, you know, if this is something I should expect from the collapse of scalars, for instance. So I'm going to show you here what happens when you take, well, a quite generic initial data. These are Gaussians with varying width and varying radius location are not. Okay, I'm taking a Gaussian pulse. I have the initial data if you want at the end. And I'm varying the width, I'm varying the location of this Gaussian and let the field collapse. Generically, what you find is the following. If the Gaussian has a large enough amplitude, you find what you expect. You have black hole, you have prompt collapse to black holes. Okay? This is this line here. So for sufficiently large amplitudes, this is amplitude versus mass times the width of this Gaussian. For sufficiently large amplitudes, you get prompt collapse to black holes. Now, this is a massive field. So you know that at sufficiently small amplitudes, you know, you can use a linearized calculation in Minkowski. And the Green's function, well, it will have a residue there. You see, you need to have a T^-3/2 decay. And you do get this. So at sufficiently small amplitudes, you always get a power law decay of the field. It doesn't collapse. At a given location, it just decays at T^-3/2. Okay? Now, but for some mass parameters, well, and width of this Gaussian, you start finding weird things. For example, I'm going to start with the collapse of a field located at R equals 5 with a width of 1.25, mass parameter 2. Okay? This is what happens. Let me play this again. This is the Gaussian. So this is the density of the field as a function of radius, and this is the amplitude normalized. This is the field normalized by the initial amplitude. And what you see is that the field is oscillating roughly at the frequency given by the mass parameter, and it looks like the density distribution is asymptoting to an almost constant value. Okay? If you wait long enough, so this is almost like an oscillator. This is a real field. Okay? If you wait long enough, I think 50 or 70, I don't remember, these guys are going to collapse. Okay? So this is this region here in the parameter space. You get delayed collapse to black holes, but you still get collapse. When you decrease the amplitude below this line here, well, we couldn't find collapse, even waiting times of order 10^4 dynamical time scales. Okay? So here we strongly suspect, well, for all practical purposes, that we have a stable oscillator, or boson star, if you wish. Okay? Summarizing, these solutions, these stars, really you know, arise out of realistic collapse of scalars. Okay?
Where do these different regions here fit on your curve of the mass versus radius?
You mean here? These guys?
Like the delayed collapse ones, or that was too heavy and that's why it collapsed? Or...
Well, so usually, I don't think always, but I'm going to come back to that point. Usually, these guys fall on the U branch. They're slightly to the left of the peak. But I'm going to come back to that point a bit later on.
Is it the vector case or?
This is the scalar case. We haven't done, I think our Finkel has one study for the vector case, but nothing systematic. Okay, so what was out there up to, I think, a couple of years ago was the following. So I know these solutions arise out of collapse. What I'm interested in answering now is, how can I grow them? If I'm going to take these seriously as, say, dark matter models, can I grow these configurations? Can I merge them inside stars or not? And for this, I really need to know how these guys interact with one another, okay? And the standard lore was that any star to the left, any star to the right of the peak value was stable. If you disturbed it, it would come back to the stable branch, okay? Any star, a star to the left of the peak value, to the unstable branch, if you disturbed it, it either collapses to a black hole or it releases enough mass that it ends on the stable branch. Let me show you a couple of examples. This is plots taken from an Alcubierre et al. Study. So this is the usual mass diagram. I'm going to take a star which is, I think, somewhere here, and I'm going to increase the value of the scalar field at the center of the star artificially. So I'm kicking the scalar field at the center, and I want to see how the star reacts. Okay? And the star reacts by releasing enough scalar field that it lands again on the stable branch or with a much lower mass. Okay? I can do the same, but instead of increasing the field, I can decrease the field. So I'm stealing a bit of mass from the star. Okay? And what the star does is basically a very similar thing. It oscillates around the stable branch, and eventually it hits the stable branch with a smaller value of the mass. So it gets rid of excess scalar field. You can do the same actually for a point on the unstable branch. So I'm getting here, I'm increasing the field by 66%, and I want to see what happens. In this particular case, the star oscillates a lot, so it's here, and it lands still on the stable branch, okay? Of course, we know, I've showed you collapse, that there are cases where if you disturb this guy, it collapses to black hole. But at least there's a vast, well, there seems to be quite a number of situations where the stable branch, where the disturbed stable branch lands on the stable branch, and the disturbed unstable branch, this is important, will also land on the stable branch, okay? This is somewhat artificial if you're looking at this as a model of dark matter. So what I'm going to try and understand now is what happens if I take two of these guys and I collide them. For example, suppose I take two oscillotrons which are at this point such that the total mass in the spacetime is above the peak value, okay? And I want to see, is this configuration going to collapse to a black hole, or is it eventually going to relax to the stable branch? So colors are the intensity of the scalar field. This is a very rapid simulation. The stars are very close to one another, but you can also see, you know, a very clear explosion here. So I'm cutting here, there's a mirror symmetry. There's another boson star here, okay? Let me play this back. You see, there's a lot of scalar field emitted here, okay? So the mass parameter is 0.54, the peak value was 0.6. So two of these guys certainly have a mass which is above the peak value. If you plot the field of one of these guys, it looks like this. This is the field at the origin as a function of time. This is an oscillotron. It's long-term stable. After the collision, you see something like this. There's a peak when the collision happens, and then the scalar field relaxes to a final value. You can measure the mass at very large distances. This is the initial mass, the total ADM mass in the spacetime. This is the final mass. It's less than 10% that of the initial value, okay? We have repeated this calculation for equal mass oscillatons. So we have repeated this for stars which are, well, not way below, but such that the total mass is still below this peak. What happens generically is that if two stars down here in the diagram collide, they are going to end up as a larger mass final star. Of course, the final mass is still smaller than the total initial mass, but it's climbing up the diagram. And the same happens for unequal mass collisions. Okay? However, generically, what you find is that if you try to climb this peak point here, you cannot. As you start approaching this point, the mass loss is so large that your stars just fall back on the stable branch.
But is the energy in the star field that you lose, whereas velocity, propagation, about many escape speed that you can come and move it down, and eventually settle into something higher?
That's not what we always get something like this, of this kind. You may be right. There may be very large time scales that we're not capturing here. That's possible. But this seems to be asymptotic to some value. This is a relatively short time scale, I agree. It's possible.
So normally when I see M of R curves that look like that, at the peak you've got an instability. Right? And every rack, the instability has gotten worse and worse.
Right.
And so normally that means that you're going to collapse. And what you're saying is you're hitting an instability which can radiate. And because it can radiate, yeah, you lose energy and go the
yeah
other direction.
Yeah, this is not new, of course. Seidel and Swen discovered this, they called it the gravitational cooling mechanism. But actually, T.D. Lee, already in 77 or something, thought, well, he knew that these solutions, that there were solutions with many nodes in the scalar. So he was conjecturing that perhaps this is not leading to collapse because the star has elsewhere to go. And so I think this is the connection with the non-nodeless solutions, basically. Yeah, so in some of these cases, what you find, well, not in this particular one, what you find is that the star, when you collide two of them, for instance, expands really a lot. So it, for intermediate times, it approaches one solution with nodes. It can be 3, 4, or 5. It's not collapsing, you see? It seems like the star knows it has elsewhere to go, so it occupies excited states and never seems to collapse. Yeah.
Well, what is fascinating is that when you take a single star and you're on this side, you have cases where the star and the curved star jump back in the field. Because you mentioned that in the collision, equal mass and unequal mass, because of course there is a regime where it can take the outer star to essentially have zero mass, and it should be back to the case where it jumps back to the field. Just very
right, so yeah, but that means I also started somewhere here, right?
No, I start right there.
Oh, at the peak?
Yeah, past the peak. Except that I have an unstable star, so I'm in an extreme
right
mass ratio collision, if you want. So
right.
I start by sitting on the left side, and then I would take a curve with the arrow. The race showed that there were cases where you were on that unstable branch, you curve and you jump back. To the
right.
Curve. So there is a limit I can take where it's not that the star is going to explode. It's going to jump back to the stable phase.
Oh, yeah, but that's what this star did. I mean, this star exploded, well, in the sense that it lost so much mass.
Rather, in the case of Bentley, it's not going to lose a lot of mass. It's just going to jump to the nearest configuration on the stable side, which has a lot of mass.
Yeah, maybe. Some of these processes seem to be very, very sensitive to where exactly you are here, and what type of kick you're giving to the star. Yeah.
I guess part of my statement and question is trying to understand this in the context of more mundane examples. So I have an oscillating star, oscillating neutron star, right? So the M of R curve looks sort of like this for a neutron star, for a white dwarf even easier. If I kick it across that peak, normally it will just fall down. I can imagine if I kick it really, really hard, maybe I can unbind some surface layer, and that's sort of the analog here. But is my intuition there just wrong, or is there something about the scalar fields, their dispersion relation that permits so much mass loss here? Is it really this non-local property that you were just describing, that you can have very extended solutions that can talk to?
It's the only thing that I can think of, yeah.
And then just another perhaps off-point question. I can't help but notice there's a lot of symmetry in your explosion in the movie that follows this slide. Is that simply the seeding of the scalar?
Well, I think this is because this is an equal mass. I mean, this has lots of symmetries. This is an equal mass collision.
I mean, you get I think three wedges, right? So there's
a. Well, I mean, you have to have this symmetry as well. This is an equal mass, so you're going to have symmetry along this axis. I have no idea. Good question. This is strongly nonlinear, I suspect. Actually, one of the things I think is completely open is trying to even linearize around boson stars or oscillators and look at what comes out. This has not been done. Okay, so in summary, self-gravitating solutions with scalar exist, they can grow, but the growth only goes so far as to the peak point, okay? So these configurations, these scalar configurations, only grow up to 10 to the minus 11 solar masses for a 1 electron volt scalar. And the collapse seems to be avoided by, well, what Seidel and Swain call the gravitational cooling mechanism. And this will be my assumption. So the question you can ask now is, well, if I take this seriously, as, say, dark matter models, can I grow these guys inside stars? The answer, of course, is yes. This is the structure of a star. This particular star has a polytropic index of 2. Well, it's basically just there to give me a compact configuration. And I'm showing you so my star has a fluid component, the usual fluid component. It's a polytropic equation of state. And that's the black line. The scalar field distribution, this is as a function of radial direction, is given by the red line. And the blue line is the star, is the fluid configuration density when there is no scalar. Okay, so the regular star. Okay? So basically, this is comparison between stars with dark matter cores and regular stars. Okay? For three different values of the boson mass. This is a boson mass such that the total mass of the star times mu is 0.1, this is 1, and this is 10. So roughly, your scalar is getting heavier in this direction, and if it gets heavier, think about the MR diagram, it also becomes more compact, smaller, okay? So here, you really have a compact core of scalar, of dark matter, if you wish, inside a very large neutron star, okay? This is the scalar distribution, and this is the fluid distribution. Now, one of the interesting things that I think we all could suspect it would happen is that all the properties of this core, so if you take this core and you put it in the MR diagram, look identical to the phase diagram of boson stars. To all purposes, this core is not seeing the star. And the reason, of course, is that it's really located at the center, right? Okay? So the question now is, if I take this seriously and I try to grow, if I think that my star is in a dense dark matter environment, so basically I have a star, it starts piling up dark matter at the core, what happens to the star? And the typical argument was based on the Chandrasekhar limit for my boson. You have a peak value, at some point it's going to collapse. If I take seriously the simulations of pure boson stars or oscillators, what's going to happen is slightly different. You grow the value of the scalar field at the center just until the peak value in the MR relation, Okay? So what this means, let me pass this, what this means is that you can only grow dark matter in the cores of stars up to this peak value. Okay?
So but you have some additional pressure due to matter outside,
right? That's right. It does. So my assumption, so yeah, it does. I think this deserves a lot more study. My reasoning is that because these cores here, so this is a large star with a small dark matter core, okay? So I'm here, mu m equals to 10. My dark matter core is this guy. If you plot the core in a mass radius relation, you will find that basically it overlaps, it overlaps with this diagram. Only for small scalar cores, okay? So I'm jumping, of course, to conclusions. My assumption is that dynamically, the cores inside stars also behave as boson stars here. It is an assumption.
Peter, I can't remember correctly, but this thing of mini boson stars and dark boson stars, in one case, we have very, very massive configurations that have significant radius.
Right.
Which one are you considering? The ones that are small?
Yeah, so those stars, you have different interaction, self-interaction terms.
Yeah.
Yeah. You have the lambda phi to the 4 or... Oh, I agree. I believe it. I mean, I don't think it was done, but it will. Some of these features.
Yeah, but just the fact that you're going to pile up so much mass in the middle, then you're going to be forced to start to collapse. And you're still
also yeah, completely. I agree.
Yeah, so that was my immediate question. As soon as I start seeing spikes in the center, density spikes in the center of the star, right now, this is just the backdrop. This is the stage on which your boson starts living.
Yeah.
Very quickly. Stage
right. Well, but that's the point. Well, that's one of the points. That's the point is that you can only grow the core up to this value. So for sufficiently large boson masses, you can never do as you want, right? You can never grow a very, very heavy core at the center of the star, right? And of course, for very light bosons, what I said fails. I don't know what happens for very light bosons. I would be here, and I have no idea how these guys behave. The boson actually extends outside the star. I don't know dynamically how they would behave. So.
But this very close case, even if you don't have high enough or a heavy enough boson star to collapse on itself, it's affecting the equation of state of the surrounding neutron star, right? Because it's changed the density profile substantially,
yeah.
Right? So
yeah.
Much higher central densities, so much.
Well, yeah, the densities change for most values we looked at. So this is one example. It's a very drastic example already. This is the Fourier components of the density of the star. And I'm multiplying the fourth mode by 10 to the sixth and the second mode by 10 to the fourth. It changes by 5% or so. You can go up to 20. I mean, it's not a drastic change, I think.
What about main sequence stars? 5% change in the center density of the
main sequence star changes
evolution.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't know, but I think that the phenomenological models that people use would probably work okay in that regard. And there have been studies of main sequence stars, you know, accreting dark matter. My point here is really that the statement that these stars eventually collapse to black holes is a long jump. This is my main point. I think there's a, you know, it's a huge jump from one fact to the other, okay? Actually, there might be observational consequences because when the scalar couples to the star material, you saw it here, the density starts oscillating, it oscillates at this frequency. It might be that you can see signs of this, or it might be that viscosity in compact stars is so important that this just dumps away. Okay?
That frequency is the characteristic frequency of the star?
Yeah, this is the fundamental mode of your star, of your...
Right, so it has nothing to do with the star field.
No, no, this is the fundamental field of the bosonic configuration, not the star. So once the field, remember your field is oscillating.
Sure, okay, you're saying you're gonna force
it. Yeah, yeah, it's forcing the star to oscillate.
And why will it not? You also have natural frequency of oscillation in the star itself.
Yeah, that's right, that's right.
So why do you care about that one in particular?
Well, because this, I know it's going to happen, and I know it's going to be there. The other depends on the stars, on the star properties. I mean, this would be universal. For any star you give me, if you fix the mass of the boson, I'm going always to see this frequency. The other frequencies of the star depend on the equation of state, on the star composition, and so on.
But the answer, are you trying to think of, it could be an associated Gaussian wave at that frequency, or because then what would be the signal occurring the most?
Well,
yeah,
I think that's a very, I never tried to address this. This is a spherically symmetric model, so no gravitational waves. There might be electromagnetic emission because the density is varying, but I never tried to model that. Do I have 5 minutes? Okay, so I discussed self-gravitating bosons. I would like to finish by discussing bosons in strong gravitational fields. In particular, bosons around black holes, and I'm going to focus on spinning black holes for a reason, and the reason is that I would like to discuss a little, for 5 minutes, superradiance. Superradiance is basically the amplification of fields by some source. It usually requires dissipation. Well, there's a long history describing superradiance. The first example I know of, it's a very special kind of superradiance, is the superradiant amplification of sound waves when you have an interface between two fluids, and one of the fluids is moving with respect to the other with a velocity mu. This is an example that's solved in Landau and Lipschitz. Of course, they solve it in one line. You need 10 lines to compute the result, but anyway, it's there. And what you find is that if you hit the interface with a sound wave, so this incident wave, and if this fluid is moving supersonically, then the scattered wave will have an amplitude which is larger than the incident wave. It's basically stealing energy away from this fluid. Okay? Actually, there's very strong and simple and very cute thermodynamical arguments that show you that superradiance is very, very general. Actually, you can even put stuff like the Cherenkov effect in the class of superradiant effects. I think Bekenstein was the first one to realize this. I'm not interested in translational, what I would call translational superradiance, so when there is translational motion. I'm interested in rotational superradiance. And the first kind of example that I think was put out there was this, is this case, not exactly superradiance, there are no waves, but in any case. So take the case of the Earth and the Moon system. The Earth is spinning at, well, a period of once a day. The Moon goes around the Earth every 28 days or so, okay? The Moon raises bulges on the star oceans. Well, my bulges are a bit funny, but anyway, they are here. This is just gravitational interaction. But because there's friction between the ocean and the Earth crust, there is a lag. So this angle is called the lag angle. I'm calling it phi. There is an angle between the bulges, the tidal bulges, and the direction between the center of the Earth and the Moon. This is quite, I think, easy to understand, right? If there's no friction, of course the bulges have to point exactly in this direction, but there's friction, so there's a lag angle. Now, because there's friction, it means that the Earth is losing angular momentum, okay? So days are getting longer. But this system, if you look at it in isolation, needs to conserve angular momentum. So the Moon needs to get farther away from the Earth. Just a consequence. Actually, people measure this. They did lunar ranging a few years ago. The moon is getting farther from the Earth, I think at the rate of 2 centimeters a year, or whatever it is. It is getting farther away. Actually, there's a nice book by Camus on this effect, because many millions of years ago, the moon was closer to the Earth, okay? Anyway, the point is that friction is basically stealing energy from one system to the other, okay? This is not exactly what I would call super radiance, because there is no wave scattering here, but the wave analog is also easy to understand. Zeldovich did this for the first time in the 70s, and it goes like this. You make a body, a spinning body with angular frequency omega, and you scatter a wave off of it. The wave would have an angular frequency omega, and if the angular phase velocity omega over the azimuthal number of the wave, this is the distribution in this azimuthal angle, m, if this guy is smaller than the rotational frequency of the body, and if there is interaction, so if there is some kind of coupling between this and this, then there is super radiance. Okay? This will be kind of the analog of this guy. If the Earth is spinning faster than this guy, there's super radiance. If not, well, there isn't. Okay? So if this guy is spinning fast enough, there's a transfer of energy from this body to the wave. Okay? You need dissipation in this system. And so Zeldovich, the first time he did it, he had to put there some, conducting material. But he also realized that in GR, you get dissipation for free, because black holes have a one-way membrane. So black holes should always have dissipation, and rotating black holes should always have super radiance. Let me show you what happens if you try to compute the amplification factors of a massless wave scattering off a curved black hole. So this is the amplification factor. If it's 100, it means that I take a wave of amplitude 1, and I get back a wave of amplitude 2. Okay? The amplification factor as a function of the frequency of my wave. I'm scattering a wave off the black hole, of the spinning black hole, and it's the frequency. This black hole is spinning at very, very large rates. Okay? 99% of the maximum possible value. You will notice that there is super radiance, of course. The peak value is not so big, so this is super radiance for scalar. The peak value is roughly 0.4% or so. The electromagnetic case, peak value roughly 4%. And gravitational case, peak value roughly 130%. And this is a plot showing you how it varies in the gravitational case, so you're sending a pulse of gravitational waves, when you vary the spin of the black hole, okay? This is our plot, but these results are out there for many decades. The funny thing, there's two funny things about super radiance. The first is that rotational super radiance has not yet been detected, as far as I know. There was some proposal 10 years ago by Bekenstein to put a rotating cylinder of conducting material and trying to develop some instability. I think there's easier ways. I think one easier way would be to use black hole analogs, and we're trying to do this with Silke in Nottingham. But in any case, it has not been experimentally observed, which is kind of fantastic. The second interesting thing, for me at least, is that when you look at these plots, you will always notice that super radiance always seems to be bounded. It's always a relatively small number. It's 0.4% for scalars, 4% for vectors, and at most 130 for tensors. So, a few months ago I started having fun with plots. So I plotted the super radiant amplification factor for charged black holes. I'm going to take a charged scalar, okay, and I'm going to scatter it off a charged black hole in any number of dimensions. The results are here. The plot is a bit lousy, but anyway. So what you find, this is the amplification factor. If it's 100, it's the same story. I send one, I get two. As a function of frequency, for different lines are different dimensions and different charge. We find the following thing. For any space-time dimension, it's just a time model, okay? For any space-time dimension, the amplification factor is at most exactly, well, numerically, 100% when the charge Q, well, of the field grows to infinity. That problem is modeled by this equation. It's a charge scalar with a charge small q, and we find that when small q goes to infinity, amplification factor goes to numerically 100%. The second case was actually a black hole analog. It's a fluid. You put some motion in the fluid, okay, and you let the fluid drain until it develops some sonic horizon, okay? That's called the draining bathtub model. Anyway, it's a more real thing. You can do it in the bathtub. This is the acoustic black hole, and I'm showing exactly the same thing. Amplification factor as a function of frequency. Now, you can tune, well, if you're smart enough in the lab, you could, in principle, tune the velocity of the fluid as it goes along in this motion, and you will find that the amplification factor goes to 100% exactly when this motion goes to, when the fluid velocity grows to infinity, okay? And this seems like a coincidence. Everything here grows to 100%, and in spinning curved black holes, it's at most 130%. In spinning black holes in other dimensions, it's even lower than that. I suspect there's a, you know, some reason for this. I don't know about the spinning case, but in the non-spinning case, you can actually prove this. So for both this case, charged black holes and fields, and this guy, the wave equation can always, so the equation governing the scalar can always be reduced to this wave equation. It's a very nice equation. And so in this case, the charge is the charge of the scalar. For this case, Q, small q would be the rotation of the fluid. And you can prove, you can use a WKB argument to prove that the amplification factor that comes out of this is exactly 100% when this q grows to infinity. It's a very nice result, very simple result. It would be nice to actually generalize this to, you know, spinning geometries, but I don't know how to do it. Anyway, let me skip this. How much time do I have?
4 minutes.
Okay. So we know superradiance exists, and you can actually use it to trigger instabilities in space-time. A trivial way to do that would be to surround your black hole by some reflecting wall. Okay? You amplify the waves at the horizon or close to the horizon, the waves go back, they're forced to reflect, amplify, you get instability. This is very artificial, but if you use massive fields instead, the mass term, as I showed you, can act as a barrier. They can confine the fields, okay? I think Damour and Deriwell were the first to realize this. But you can actually show this. You can compute the effective wave equation for scalar propagation. You will find it has an effective potential, and that the potential has some well at some distance far away from the spinning black hole, okay? So the field tends to pile up here. There's a decaying tail that extends into the ergo region of the spacetime. It's stealing negative energy from the black hole, and it's growing. You develop an instability, and the way we characterize instability is by the eigenvalue for the frequency. And it turns out to be approximated by this. So the field develops an eigenmode that rings at a frequency close to the mass parameter mu, and has so it's unstable. It means that it develops a small imaginary component that grows like mu m to the 9. Mu m is that dimensionless parameter I gave in the beginning. Okay, so there's mu m for all purposes is very small, at least for astrophysical black holes, which means that the instability timescale can be quite large. Okay, but there is an instability. For example, if you evolve Gaussian around this is a nearly maximum spinning black hole, you will find something like this. Okay, we're evolving, I don't know, for 1,000 m's or so. These states are very long-lived. The field is slowly growing. We think it's extracting rotation from the black hole. If the field is complex, it might even be the case that because this is time-independent, you develop a truly new solution describing a spinning black hole and some hair outside, okay? I'm going to skip this. I need to skip a lot of stuff. Okay. How much time do I have? 1 minute? Okay, I'm out of time. Let me just skip with my main point. So massive fields outside spinning black holes develop instabilities, okay? What instability is doing is basically stealing kinetic rotational energy away from the black hole and depositing the energy into the scalar field. So as time goes by, the black hole spins down and the scalar cloud grows, okay? Of course, this is a non-spherically symmetric cloud. Eventually, it develops a non-zero quadrupole moment. It releases gravitational waves. If you evolve the full system, including gravitational wave emission, superradiance from the black hole, and even possible accretion by the black hole, if you have an accretion disk around the black hole, you'll find something like this. And this, I swear, is the next to last slide, okay? I'm evolving 10 to the cubed black holes with random distributions of mass and spin, and I'm putting there a 10 to the minus 18 electron volt boson, a field, okay? After you evolve them for roughly a Hubble time scale, you will find the following, let me call this the Reggie diagram. It's a diagram of angular momentum of the black hole, dimensionless, versus the mass of the black hole. What you will find are gaps in the Reggie plane, these gaps here. You do not expect, well, you will not find any black hole there, because it means that if a black hole was here, the instability was so large that on those timescales it lost all the spin, okay? Now, if you look at observations and you start putting real black holes in this diagram, you will basically be able to exclude certain mass ranges, okay? This is the game. And if you do this, you will find that, for instance, vector fields in this simplified assumption would be excluded with masses smaller, with masses larger than 10 to the minus 20 electron volt, okay? So the only way that, for instance, this guy, this is Ferrell 9, would be allowed to exist was that if there is any massive boson, its mass was smaller than 10 to the minus 20 electron volt, okay? By the way, this is two orders of magnitude smaller than the bound that you would find for scalars in the particle data group, and it comes from accelerator bounds, okay? So it means that if you believe that astrophysical systems are as clean as you wish them to be, these can start imposing constraints on fundamental fields, okay? And I think I will finish. Thanks.
So we have a model-dependent spin measurement for M87, which is it's almost 7 billion solar masses. So that pushes your limits up by an order of magnitude.
7 billion solar masses. So you'll be
off the right by a good margin. And that spins pretty hot.
Yeah, how much?
0.95, as many signals you like.
Is that right? Well, yeah.
It's model-dependent. So now, we could argue about that. But yeah, so that would, what scalar field masses would that kill? It's like 10 to the minus
22 or so, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah.
Any other questions?
How fast does it spin, by the way?
At this point,
85.
Probably faster than that. Peter is here to
October 14th.